So I know of one person who actually finished the homework. What about the rest? How is it going? I see a no right over there. Speak up, Mike.
So I was the one who had the shader, or that shader idea, so I'm going to scrap that.
So there's no straightforward way. Every way is going to take you on a journey, okay, of discovery. And, you know, you can do it alone, or, you know, you can share your problems with everybody in the list and get help that way. I don't even know them. Honestly, I do not even know them. You know, I just go and say, okay, so what doesn't work? You know, what do I need? And, you know, just go through them in the documentation and, yeah. And I haven't really done anything of significance with fixed function pipeline for many years. In the end, you know, shaders are easier. It's a program, you know, you do whatever you want in it. You know, you just need to get the correct values in the right place. You know, you need to understand basically your inputs and your outputs. And everything else is just programming in shader language. The other hurdle, which somebody else was having, is how to get those stupid shaders to compile and to be imported in the game. So, who here thinks that they have a problem with that? Okay, nobody. So that was my next question. So who here, you know, thinks that they might have a problem with that if they attempted that? So several of you are basically going for just fixed function pipeline, you know, simple lighting that way, right? Okay. So okay, compiling a shader is not a difficult task. You do need to invoke the compiler tool. I mean, how do you compile C++? Anybody? GCC? Well, I don't do that, but yeah. You know, I'm from the other side of town. But yeah, you call GCC, you give it your C file, right? Or C++ file, and hopefully it's going to do something smart with it. And maybe you need to tell it things. Like, if you're including files, maybe you have to do, you know, dash I, capital I, right? And then put some path so that it can find header files there. Or maybe you need to put dash capital D to define some macros, like, you know, debug, because I want to do debugging stuff, and that's the standard macro for it. Or maybe I want to specify, you know, that it is really a C++ file, right? So I need to put some switch to tell it that. Or maybe, I mean, there are, in GCC or in CL, which is the Microsoft C and C++ compiler, there are in the order of several dozen different switches to do different things to the compiler. You know, to tell the compiler different things about how to deal with your source code, with your program, and how to build it. This is no different. The tool is called FXC. It is there in DirectX, you know, in the SDK. When you install the SDK, you have it there. And it's called FXC. And you just need to give it your shader file, and it will spew out the result of compiling it. It has switches. You can select what kind of output you want. It can output a binary file. It can output a header file that you can just pound include in your source code. Mm. you need to specify what kind of shader it is. Is it the Fredix shader? Is it the pixel shader? Is it 2.0 model or 3.0 or 1.4, right? Shader model. What's the name of your main function in your shader? You know, there's actually a switch for that. Most switches, you don't really need to use them. You know, you just call it with the source code, with the source file, and it spews out the, you know, the resulting object file. For shaders, that's just a binary file. You don't care what's in it, in there. It's just a bunch of bytes. You load it up using your favorite C++ method. Fopen, std streams, whatever. Okay? You load it up in memory, and you feed it to create Vertex Shader in the D3D device. That's it. I'm not dictating how you should do it. The way I did it in Hardware Renderer and then in the game project post-process files is I added a custom rule for Visual Studio so that Visual Studio would recognize the shader files. And then had that custom rule generate a header file, which is not .h, I called it, .vfxobj or pfxobj. So when you're building, it just calls it and generates those files, and then you just need to pun include them somehow. Okay? I mean, that's the way I did it. Why? Because then I modify my shader and then compile and run, and it works. I don't need to load files. You know, I don't need to do anything like that. It is part of the source code of my game. In the Hardware Renderer, I also showed how to invoke D3DX in order to compile it at runtime. Meaning, the game starts running and then it goes and starts compiling. You know, after the game starts. The game itself does the compilation. That's another way. So, there you have three different ways. Ultimately, they pull from the same code. FXC is just a program compiled against D3DX. And it calls the same function that I used in Hardware Renderer. So, each and every one of you, when you get shaders, you know, you pick your poison, how you prefer to handle them.
Now, yes? In your game sample with Visual Effects, what is the post-process doing? Anti-aliasing? What does it actually do? Is it a pixel shader or something else?
In that case, I just had a pixel shader.
Okay.
I mean, it was a post-processing thing, so I just completely skipped over the Vertex shader part. By using the flexible vertex format, you know, the 3D FBF, XYZ, RHW. Remember, that one makes it so none of the vertex pipeline runs. What you have in your vertex buffer, what you have in your vertices, goes directly to the rasterizer and gets interpolated in the rasterizer and then fed into the pixel shader.
Now, it is possible to have some things rendered with a vertex shader and then set vertex shader null.
Of course. Every single... I go back to one of the first classes that we had. Okay, the GPU is a state machine. You set vertex shader is a state setting function like many, many others. It just modifies the device in preparation to run one of those draw primitive or draw index primitive functions.
So I don't know if you mentioned this before I came, but if you could go over a little more about how you... we do have the code for the homework 3 and your game example, but if you could go more over how you fed the things that we saw in our versions of the pixel shaders that we had worked on, the constants and the vertices.
Okay.
I don't know if anybody else wants that as well, because in the last homework, we just modified the VFX and PFX files, not any C code that was loading stuff into it. Does that make sense?
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, that homework 3 was about you writing shader code.
Right.
Okay. Exactly. So the other side of the interface, okay, so let me pull this up. So we saw some of this here. In the shader, okay, it's this semantics and this semantics. What dictates how that shader communicates with the rest of the universe, okay? So that's basically how it's done, okay, in the shader files through semantics. Let's see. So for the shader inputs, like this one's here, okay, it links through the vertex declaration or the flexible vertex format. Flexible vertex format is a bunch of, you know, it's a simplified version of this that only does a few things, but it's enough for many purposes, okay? So in your vertex, you have position, you have normal, you have texture coordinates 0, texture coordinates 1, you have a color, diffuse color, okay? And they go into the shader to the corresponding semantics here.
I did skim through the homework 3 solution code, and I didn't see that structure you were going through, the slide, that one.
Yeah.
And something else that was like set constants, start a register, whenever.
Yeah. So there is the other one. Okay, so that's linkage between pixel and vertex shader, which is fine. And I guess I didn't quite do the constants in here.
No.
Okay. So let me then. So constants are really no different. So in here, in there you saw that it has, you know, the register S0 for the texture.
Right.
And that's the index of texture. You can have several different textures. Okay. In one single shader. Okay, so in the hardware renderer, the big thing was the vertex shader. The vertex shader has a bunch of constants. Okay, those do not change within a single execution of the shader. In fact, they do not change within a single draw primitive. Okay. All of the vertices get the same constants. That is the whole point of this. And I basically assign registers to them. Those registers go into indices here. Okay. Yeah. 1 second. That goes actually into here. Oops. Okay. That goes in here. So this is a function that says set vertex shader constant. Okay. And it says starting at constant 0, do 19 of them. Okay. Each constant is for floats, x, y, z, and w. And it's setting 19 of them. And this is just a pointer to all the floats of all those constants. Okay. That's what links to here. There's 19 ones from 0 to 18. And that's how you get information into your shader. Now, what you saw up here, where it says VS constants 17.y.z.w, okay, this is just setting values in the array in preparation for the call before down there, which is the one that sends it to through directory to the GPU.
One thing I could do is, let's say I have a variable number of lines, is I could put in 18 and put in some integer saying there's going to be 5 lines and then five.
And then you can do a loop. Stuff. Yes.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. That is possible.
How many registers are
there?
How many registers?
Registers? For constants, it was for vertex shader 2.0, it was, I don't know if it was 128 or 256. I don't remember the particulars of the limitations. But does that answer your question? Okay. So, more questions? Nothing? No? Everything sounds good? Okay. Let me repeat these again. Okay. Don't bang your head against the homework. Do not bang your head against the homework. You don't understand something, or you just plain don't know how to do something, go ahead and ask in the list. Other people in the class might have actually gotten through that, so they can answer if I am not promptly reading my email. And if all this fails, eventually I will answer.
Do you have examples running this code on how you render the multiple render targets? I can't find a good example. Render multiple render targets.
No. I mean, there are samples in Direct3D that do that. But Direct3D samples use the DXUT framework very extensively. And they kind of delegate everything that they can to the framework. So then you have to navigate the framework source code, which is kind of convoluted because they support Directory 9 and 10 at the same time. So, I mean, it's a big gripe that I have with them. I know that it makes their job easier when they make samples, but it is less educational that way. So no, there is no example about how to do that. But there is not a lot of secret either. So like multi-sample? No. Yes, but that's not multiple rendered targets. So before I posted it, or right after I posted it the first time, I went in and said, okay, so, you know, how can I make this a little more interesting? And I figured, hey, you know, I could have more than one buffer and then ping pong between them. So, you know, if one pass of anti-aliasing is not enough, maybe four of them is enough to make it, well, anti-aliased. Okay. But what that means is I have two buffers and I read from one and write to the other one. And then I swap them and I read from the one I just wrote into and write in, you know, overwrite the first one because I don't need it anymore. Right. And that's the ping-ponging. You know, I also thought that, you know, for those of you trying to do bloom filters, which do need to do that, you know, that might be a good thing to show. But multiple rendered targets is having two rendered targets and rendering to both of them at the same time. It feels kind of like what you would do if you were going to render stereoscopic 3D, right? Where you have two images from slightly different points of view. So you render the same thing to both. But it doesn't work for that. Because there's only one rasterizer. And that one rasterizer interpolates all the attributes, and then the pixel shader is the one that generates two colors for the same pixel. And, you know, you can use that for, honestly, anything you want. I mean, rendering two colors means that you end up with two images. Those two images having generated from the same rasterization of all the triangles in your scene. Okay, so the triangles are in exactly the same position in both images. It's just like having more components. When you render, normally you have up to four components. Red, green, blue, and alpha. You can render all four components. You can put whatever you want there. Imagine that you want morph for some reason. One reason is one of those motion blur techniques where you write into a buffer the screen space velocity of your points. So if you have something that's moving from left to right on the screen, it gets vectors that point in the X direction. That's two components. In screen space, you know, two components is enough for a velocity, right? Is it moving right, left, up, or down? You know, that's two directions. So that's one reason to do that. Another one is to write depth values. Depth values are useful when you want to do things like depth focus type effects. I mean, you've seen this in movies, right? The camera actually focuses at a certain distance and everything else gets blurred. The most extreme case of that that I remember is in that movie, there's something about Mary. You know, there's that scene where the guy is in the bathroom and looks out the window and there's these birds and everything else is completely blurred. And then they do the trick with the camera. They change the focus depth. Move it further away and, you know, there is actually a window for, you know, beyond the birds. And there is the girl, you know, and hilariousness ensues and all that. Okay. In order to do that, you need to know for every pixel, you know, what depth it is. Right. So then you can do the blurring appropriately. As a post-process. So in order to do that sort of thing, it's just, you only need two things. First, in a pixel shader like this, you need to output two colors, color 0 and color 1. You can do that by returning some structure that contains two colors. Color 0 and color 1 for the semantics. I mean, you know how to output multiple values. The vertex shader does that, typically. Well, it's the same thing.
So when I do set render target, I do.
And then when you do set render target, you know, one of the parameters is an index, right? So you set one render target to 0 and the other one to 1 index. And that's it. There is the limitation that they typically have to be, you know, depending on the GPU. But if you want it to work reasonably, you know, they both have to be the same bit depth. So you cannot have a render target that's 64 bits per pixel and another one that's 32 bits per pixel. Doesn't work. In some GPUs.
Does it also have to be the same screen size? Or 32 by 32 pixels?
Probably best. Not to, you know, it's when you start trying to, you know, put mismatched resources like that, that are supposed to go in parallel, you're starting to play with fire. However, for instance, it's very common to have one single depth buffer. And no matter what your render target size is, you use the same depth buffer, which is big enough for any. So GPUs tend to do that better. You know, the bit depth is what they don't like to be different for some reason.
You can't use fixed function.
No. Fixed function cannot output to more than one render target, no. Fixed function is old school. Fixed function is like programming in C, and shader is like programming in C++, right? Or Java or something. Okay, it's different. Okay. More questions? Going once, going twice. Okay, moving on. There. So, actually, So, I thought we'd try and finish our math talks. Today, the main theme of the class is going to be animation. You know, and we're going to do a whole bunch of things related to animation. And it's going to be kind of math heavy, so just peel your eyes with this stuff. So, we're just going to do some more advanced math, and some of it I'm going to gloss over it. I mean, it's not like you need to know everything about everything right here. But at least I want you to have the most minimal exposure to concepts that are used today in games. And then we're going to see a little bit about physics. Yes?
Are we going to get into relativity and quantum mechanics?
Relativity and quantum mechanics? Absolutely not. But thank you for asking. In here, everything is very Newtonian. Okay? Anything that we do in games is a cheat. Anything and everything. How close it is to reality depends as much in how it tricks our perception as in how physically and mathematically accurate things are. However, it's always good to remember that there is a physical world that works in a certain way. And that all that we do is approximate it. So whenever we can actually do something that's close, at least close, to the real thing, we should keep it.
Wasn't one of the video links of those boxes falling down an example of physics?
Yes. That is one example of physics, and you know, we'll play that video at one point. How about that? Let's play it. Okay, so this is where we stopped with the math slides. I split them. I think I like it. I'm going to keep it for next year. So split the math in two. So this is a first, but anyway, this part probably should go with the first part. This is simple. LERP, linear interpolation. Okay. It's, moving between A and B. I mean, we've seen it. We've used it. Everybody knows what LERP is. It works on basic arithmetics. Okay, one problem with LERP is that it doesn't work well with matrices. Okay, when you want to interpolate matrices, LERP, you can't use LERP. That's basically a LERP for each one of the components of the matrix, component by component. But that doesn't give you pretty much ever what you want. The results end up being nonsensical. Okay, and there are reasons for that. There is another thing that's interesting to know about LERPs. LERP is not the only way of interpolating between two points, and we'll see some examples of that in the animation slides. But ultimately, everything can be expressed as a series of LERPs, and LERP is kind of like one of those building blocks. Okay. One thing that's very interesting sometimes is to understand what is this thing about logarithmic space. And this is the way that I have of understanding it. So I have a ball, okay, size 1. And then I have another one that's a size 100. So what's the midpoint? When you think about that, size 50 is one answer. Well, 50 and a half, right? That's one answer. But the thing is, a ball that's size 50 is only about half as big as a ball that's size 100. But if a ball that's size 1 is much, much less than half as big as a ball size 50. Okay. So when you're talking about sizes, which accumulate by multiplying instead of by adding, then all your math has to be different. Instead of the usual LERP with multiplication and addition, you need these other kind of LERP, which uses multiplication and exponentiation. I mean, exponentiation is to multiplication like multiplication is to addition. Multiply something by 5, and it's adding it 5 times. Well, elevate something to the power of 5, and it's like multiplying it 5 times. Okay? So it's basically the same sort of relationship. It's one step up from addition and multiplication. So you can actually just do that. You know, use it exactly like you would use a LERP, only substituting addition with multiplication and multiplication with exponentiation. And this is what's called a geometric weighted average. Same as, you know, the LERP is an arithmetic weighted average. Okay. So logarithms are just a way of turning, you know, basically stepping down from that set of operations. You know, it allows you to step down from the multiplication and exponentiation down to addition and multiplication. It's basically what they do. So if you have values that are accumulated by multiplying, then you can always take the logarithm and then just do regular LERPs and regular arithmetic with it. Once you're done operating with the values, you need to convert back with exponentiation, which is the opposite of the logarithm. Okay. And this can crop up multiple times, you know, in different ways.
This log is to the base E.
It just has to be the same base, right? You know, I mean, they have to be the inverse of each other. This logarithm and exponentiation. Typically, it's natural logarithm, which the base is this strange number e. You know, cosine of pi, you know, is one of those infinite numbers that Who knows why nature likes it so much? you know, it's up there with the golden ratio and, you know, others like that. So, yeah, transcendental, but very specific. Just crazy.
Raised to the power of pi I equals negative 1.
What?
E raised to the power of pi times I imaginary numbers equals negative 1.
Oh. Yeah, well, yeah, that's, let's not get into complex numbers yet. Okay, let's actually get into complex numbers.
So F0 and F1 have to be positive.
Yeah, I mean, I say that, you know, exponentiation is to multiplication like multiplication is to addition. But there are always gotchas and differences, okay? And mathematicians have lots of fun with them. In this case, okay, so addition is commutative, right? It doesn't matter if you what you put first. Multiplication is also commutative. It doesn't matter what you put first. When you get to exponentiation, suddenly it's not commutative anymore. Okay, it matters which one is in the exponent and which one is the base. Okay, you can't just swap them anymore.
So if F0 or S1 is negative, you can just move them over so they're both positive and then move them back.
Yeah.
Only if you have non-fractional problems. Only if you have non-fractional problems. If A is like some fraction, it only works with negative problems. You'll get complex.
Yeah, okay, so yeah, no. In order to elevate to one of those powers, you know, S0 and S1, you know, should be positive or else bad things can happen. Okay. Then again, you know, when something is accumulates by multiplication, typically you don't have positive and negative. I mean, what does it mean something of size negative 2? It's like completely nonsensical again, right? When you talk about scales, it goes from 0 all the way to infinity. And the midpoint is 1, okay? and 0 is kind of like the negative infinity there. You know, you can get very close to it, but never reach it.
I suppose a mirror image could be negative size.
Mm-hmm.
Like if you scale like x negative 2, you just flip it.
When things accumulate by multiplication, negative numbers don't quite make sense. Okay. Anyway, let's move on. We have quaternions. Quaternions were actually invented in the 1800s. Okay, people back there were crazy. They did all sorts of crazy things with math that are difficult even today, you know, for regular people. And, you know, they just figured these things out for some reason. So, you know, back then they invented all sorts of different kinds of weird numbers. Okay. One of them is the complex numbers, which you all have heard about and probably dealt with at some point, in school. Hopefully. Maybe. Okay. So complex numbers are just, you know, somebody said, well, you know, you know square roots, right? When you have the square root of a negative number, what does it mean? It's, you can't do that. Okay. Well, somebody said, well, what if I actually invent a number that's the result of square root of negative 1? It's not a normal number. It's not between negative infinity and positive infinity. It's not in there. It's just something else. Look, it's like in hyperspace. Okay. It's outside of the normal realm of numbers. But we can give it a name. It's called I. Okay. We can give it a name. So then, you know, we can actually invent a new type of number that has two components. You know, one of them is, you know, like in the normal realm of numbers, and then another one in a different dimension. So it's a two-dimensional kind of number. But you can do arithmetic with this any way you want. I mean, if you have I is one number, if you multiply by itself, you get negative 1, you know, which you can't do with normal numbers. So you can operate with it, and this is just normal arithmetic. You know, once, you know, you just operate this like you do with polynomials or anything else. And then whenever you find like two i's like that, it becomes negative one. You find three i's, it's negative I. You know, because it's negative one times I, right? It's just, everything works like normal numbers. And they figured that they could express all sorts of normal operations that you know about numbers. You could express them for these complex numbers. And they've become very, very useful. If you ever do like sound analysis, you know, analysis particularly of waves, but you know, it's very applicable to sound, they crop up all the time. Because a sound wave has frequency and a phase. And those things actually matter quite a bit. You have two sounds with the same frequency. If they are in opposite phases, then they actually cancel each other. They become silence. You know, but if they're not, then they actually add to each other. So it becomes something louder. So the phase can matter a lot in sound. And with a complex number, they can actually express both, you know, frequency and phase at the same time in one number. And it's used everywhere. Okay? They're just numbers of a different kind. Well,
I think the guy who originally invented I was trying to say they didn't exist, so he invented it and tried to come to a contradiction, only he couldn't.
Yeah. If he found that the mathematical system with those types of numbers is actually very consistent. That's what he found. We just don't know. I mean, they're not normal numbers. Okay. Well, then people said, well, you know, why just I? Can't we do like a three-dimensional thing, right? You know, like with three components, you know, three dimensions. And, you know, this guy Hamilton tried for a long time and he couldn't. Okay. He just banged his head against it until he found, hey, you know, I actually need four. I can do it with four. I can't do it with three for some reason. But I can do it with four. And he invented the quaternions. Quaternions are like complex numbers, only they have I, J, and K. Okay, three different components that are imaginary in some freaky way. They are not normal numbers. Okay. And again, just like with complex numbers, the whole mathematical system applies to them. You know, you can take sines and cosines of those, you can exponentiate them, you can use them as exponents, you can do whatever. You know, any mathematical operation that you can think of, you can somehow apply to them. And it kind of works. So, somebody, I don't really know who, but somebody later in last century, figure out that, you know, this actually applies to three-dimensional space. So when you take a quaternion like this and you make it normalized, so its magnitude is 1, you know, magnitude as, you know, the square root of a square plus b square plus c square plus d square, you know, those being the four components, you know, the four dimensions of the quaternion, right? The four coefficients. Which I've called, you know, Q of X, Y, Z, and W over there. So when this is 1, that actually represents a rotation and has very, very interesting properties when you use it to represent a rotation. One of them is that it's cheaper than a matrix. A matrix for a rotation has 9 numbers. This one has 4, less than half. Memory savings. Okay, back in the day, that was great. They also found that there are some gotchas, like there are 2 normalized quaternions for every rotation. You know, you negate the whole thing and it represents the same rotation. Okay. And it was found that different operations that you can do with quaternions, you know, represent natural operations that you might do with rotations. Okay. So, well, addition and subtraction are just arithmetic things that you use to operate with the quaternions. Of course, they need to end up normalized, so you can't just use them for indiscriminately. This thing, the quaternion product, basically multiplying two quaternions together, when they're unit quaternions, you end up with a unit quaternion again. And the result of multiplying two quaternions that represent rotations is the accumulation of those rotations. So quaternions accumulate by multiplication. Matrices accumulate by rotation. If you remember, in order to apply one transformation and then another one, you multiply the matrices. That's because rotation seems to be kind of accumulate my multiplication type of thing. Okay, so it applies with all the logarithmic space and geometric average that I talked about before. Okay. Another thing that's important to notice about quaternions is that they have x, y, and z components, and those have actually kind of three-dimensional, a good three-dimensional meaning to them, which we're going to see in a moment. The W is kind of special. The last component is special. It's special in that because it's a unit quaternion, one of the four components can be calculated from the other three. And usually, this is the one. Right? So quite often we'll write them like this. Just, the vector part and the scalar part to it. And the scalar part can be calculated from the vector part. One thing that's kind of interesting is, the inverse of a quaternion is actually just negating one of the two main parts, either the vector or the scalar part. When you multiply one quaternion cube by its inverse, written like this, you end up with one. Basically, 0, 0, 0, and 1 for the real part. Same thing as with matrices. If you invert a matrix and multiply, take a matrix and multiply it by its inverse, then you end up with the identity matrix, the one that has zeros everywhere except in the main diagonal. So if you have a vertex, you can add a zero to it for its real part, right? And then you can rotate it by any quaternion that represents a rotation by applying this this operation. And this is, this makes it into a quaternion, and then you just multiply the quaternions. There's another implementation, which is these vector part of the quaternion is actually a three-dimensional vector, and that's the axis of rotation. Any rotation that you can possibly ever think about, it's a rotation around an axis by some angle. Okay? It doesn't really matter what you are rotating or, how it ends up. If I have this, okay, this is one orientation. This one is another one. Okay? You can get from this one to this one just by rotating around some axis. Any two rotations, any two orientations. Okay. So if you have that axis and how the angle that you're rotating around, then you can build a quaternion like this. Nice and simple. There are, of course, the 3D X functions to do all this. To multiply quaternions, to get the inverse of quaternions, to make up a quaternion from its axis and angle. And they're used because it's a lot easier to interpolate them. The interpolation is called a slurp. And slurp can be defined on any multidimensional thingy. Okay? In two dimensions, in three dimensions, in four dimensions, it doesn't really matter. But it's using quaternions to interpolate orientations. And orientations are very important. When you have a spaceship, you know, it starts like this, and it wants to go that way, you can actually smoothly turn it that way by doing something like the slurp. Okay. This is the general formula for a slurp. Again, this can be any vectors of any quantity, right? What you're doing is finding something that's in between the two. The only thing you need is the angle in between them. How do you get the angle between two vectors of any dimension? It doesn't really matter. How do you get the angle? Dot product. If the vectors are normalized first, the dot product is the cosine of that angle. Okay. This thing about quaternions being the same as their inverse is kind of interesting in one way. Okay. Just imagine that I am in Seattle and say Benjamin here is in New York. Okay. So what is the interpolation? You know, the most straight interpolation between New York and Seattle. And there are two. There is the short way and the long way. Okay. And which two quaternions you choose will dictate whether interpolation will go the short way or the long way. So all slurp functions have more logic to figure out, you know, if they need to invert one of the quaternions and that sort of thing. But it's just something to be aware of. If you ever see the implementation of one of those slurp functions, you know, they actually have several ifs. You know, if the angle is very close to zero, then this kind of doesn't work because the sine of zero is zero, and so you dividing by zero doesn't really make computers happy, so they go and do it differently. They say, okay, I'm just going to do it linearly, slurp, you know, when it's really, really close. And then they have decisions about whether it's negative or not and that sort of thing. Okay. It is somewhat complex kind of operation. Of course, you can always take the logarithm of a quaternion. Again, you know, quaternions are numbers and all operations apply to them in some way. So you can calculate pretty much anything about quaternions. And, you can calculate logarithms and exponentiation of quaternions. But logarithms, which are a very strange kind of operation in normal numbers, are actually very simple in quaternions. So when you have a quaternion like this, which is a unit quaternion, okay, which can be represented as a unit vector and the sine and cosine of, you know, half of the angle. The logarithm is actually just the vector multiplied by the half angle. And then a zero. Always. Guaranteed. Which is kind of nice and interesting. You know, it's simple in comparison to, how quaternions work with real numbers. How logarithms work with real numbers. So this has also been used in animation systems in games. In particular, I did use it in one game very, very extensively. And, it was fun because it wasn't as easy as it sounds. If, say you're doing 2D, two-dimensional, animations, okay? you represent rotations by just an angle. Rotations are angles, right? You know, they're positive if you rotate left, for instance, and negative if you rotate right. Hmm. But there is always also the choices of how you interpolate between two angles, right? I mean, if you have, so this is 0, this is 90, right? This is 270, and then this is 360 degrees, okay? So if I have two angles, one of them is 1 and the other one is 359, you know, how do I interpolate between them? And the thing is, you can choose to pick the short route, or you can actually just say, hey, you know, just express the angles in such a way that you can actually express multiple turns. Mm. I mean, imagine that you are animating a ballerina, right? The ballerina goes, doo, right? It would be kind of nice to actually be able to express how many turns she makes in the course of the animation. Mm. You can do that by having the angle actually express number of loops. So like an angle of, 2,000 degrees is a whole bunch of loops. Mm. Okay. But with quaternions, it's more like there's actually a way to draw this that's not too horrible. The quaternions are four-dimensional, but we can say, hey, you know, let's just represent them as, like two-dimensional quantities, just for mentalizing purposes, you know, for picturing them mentally. So we have that, say, a quaternion that's here, okay, is the same as actually the opposite quaternion. Remember, you know, like negative quaternion represents exactly the same thing as the positive quaternion, right? So these two represent the same orientation, right? But also, if we're using logarithms, then like 360 degrees times the angle, okay, will represent the same orientation again, right? So what this means is this is the same as this and is the same as this one, okay? And it's analogous to having big angles that have multiple loops in them, okay? But the thing is now, let's say we have this orientation here and this one, right? Now we can choose to interpolate this way, or that way, or that way. I mean, it gets complicated, okay? Choosing the best way to interpolate between two of those. Mm. So I don't recommend that you get into them unless you are, you get comfortable with regular quaternions, and you know, it's a different kind of step up. Nice thing about them is you can just lerp them any way you want, and you can... You can do any sort of interpolation that you normally do with numbers.
In the first slide, you said something that the speed changes. What's that about?
Hmm?
In the first slide in the sequence, you said something about if the speed changed over the path or something. Maybe it was the first quaternion slide or the first in this whole series.
Huh? Oh. So just imagine, okay, so this is just the problem with regular lerp and vectors. Imagine that I have a cube, right? In this case, a square, because we can draw 2D much better than 3D. Okay. We have four vertices. What are the normals at those vertices? Well, the normals will probably go to something like that. That one goes that way, and that one goes that way, and that one goes that way. Okay. The interpolation between those two normals, say for a point in the middle, something like this, which is smaller than a unit vector. Okay. It's not normalized anymore. Hmm. Not only that, the interpolation between two normals that are even more in opposition, say a normal like this and a normal like that, okay? It's like this, like this, something like that, okay? So basically, if one thing that we can do is just renormalize, say, you know, we get this vector and then we say renormalize, just make sure that it's normalized. But the end result is not something that's like constant speed turning of a vector. Okay. Slow. It's a little more like a Doppler effect. Right? A little bit like that. Okay. In the middle of the interpolation, it's like it's moving faster. If you measure how much it's moving by angles, it's moving very little here and a lot, you know, faster in the middle. That's why I say it's not constant speed. There's actually an article, I put the link in there, excuse me, in the page, about a guy who started thinking about this and, you know, figure out that there are like three different properties that we want in an interpolation. One of them is constant speed. The other one is the shortest path. And the other one is for it to be commutative, right? You know, it doesn't matter if you go one way or the other. And there are three ways of interpolating orientations, right? Or quaternions in general. One of them is just linear interpolation and renormalizing. The other one is the slurp. And the other one is the logarithm space interpolation, you know, just using lerps there. And each one of those gives us two of the properties and fails at the third one, okay? And they just take turns which one they fail in. The logarithm space interpolation does not follow a straight path. It actually waves somewhat. But it's constant speed, okay? And it is commutative. And, you know, the other ones, well, linear interpolation and renormalization is not constant speed. And the slurp, it's not commutative. Okay. So, anyway, math is fun for those who like it. Okay. I don't really want to spend a lot more on this. Just make sure that you know what a quaternion is when it represents a rotation. It is a normalized, you know, magnitude of one always. And you can multiply them to concatenate rotations. You can apply them to vertices. Of course, D3DX gives you functions to convert from and to rotation matrices. So, you know, you can just use those functions in order to get your quaternions if you want them. Okay. One very nice thing about them is they are just 4 bytes instead of 9. For rotations. When you're trying to do skinning and matrix palettes, maybe, you know, it's kind of nice to be able to have a lot more of them in one single set of constants.
Is this used in networking? You send a quaternion instead of a rotation matrix?
Yeah, I mean, if it is one way of compressing. If you know that it just expresses a rotation, matrix can express a lot more, like a share, and there's no way to do that with a quaternion. You can express with a quaternion, you can express rotation with scale if it's not normalized, you know. But it gets kind of weird. I mean, when you rotate a vertex, you know, you multiply the quaternion twice, right? So, you know, expressing the rotation there is kind of interesting. Okay. Spherical harmonics is, you know, something that's been a buzzword for years now. They allow some interesting tricks with lighting. So, let me tell you a little story. So, Do you know what a basis function, you know, a basis set of functions is? Anybody knows what I'm talking about when I say that? No? Do you remember when we talked about frames of reference? What is a frame of reference? What does it consist of?
That's a basis is those three unit vectors of time and space. So it's a very simple way.
Yeah. So a frame of reference is some origin point and then the three vectors. Right. And the three vectors are what you apply the coordinates of your points and your normals and everything to. Okay. If you have point, you know, 3, 4, and 5 for x, y, and z, that means you take those three numbers and you, conceptually multiply them to the three basis vectors of the frame of reference in order to find where it is in space. So, in general, in math, when you have vectors, when you have x, y, and z, okay, vectors, you know, with numbers in them, in the coefficients, what it is just the numbers that you multiply to thingies, okay, and those thingies can be vectors if you're expressing positions or orientations or directions in 3D space, or they can be other things. For instance, everybody knows what a polynomial is. Anybody doesn't? Okay. So a polynomial is when you have like x cubed, you know, with some number plus something like that. That's a polynomial. And it expresses a function. Okay. Some function. Depending on what those A, B, C, and D numbers are, it will be one function or some other. Okay? Well, this is a vector. A, B, C, and D. In many ways, that's just a vector of a sort. It's just a bunch of numbers that are put together. And each vector applies to a different sort of basis functions. The basis functions are x cubed, x squared, x, and 1. Those are the functions. Okay. Well, there is actually a, you can choose any set of functions for this. In like Fourier analysis, which is used a lot in sound, for instance, the functions are sines and cosines. Like, you know, it's like sine of x and sine of 2x, sine of 3x, and things like that. Okay? And you apply coefficients to them, add them together, and it represents a function, an approximation of a function. Okay? And you can put anything you want as the basis functions. They all have to be independent, right? You can't be able to find one function just by, you know, combining others with coefficients. You know, you could not use 2x cubed as another function because, you know, these two are kind of codependent. You know, they're the same one with some scaling. So they have to be independent in some ways. Okay. There is a special relationship that some sets of functions have, and that's that they are orthogonal. It's a little bit analogous to having a set of basis vectors for a frame of reference, okay, which are perpendicular to each other. You know, it's kind of special. Okay. When you use those, then you can rotate nicely and easily things. You know, when you don't have that sort of special relationship, you know, things, operations get more complicated. Okay. Orthogonality is very, very nice when you want to simplify your math. These ones are not orthogonal. Okay. There are different sets of polynomials that are, you know, always within certain ranges. For instance, in between 0 and 1, okay, and I recently actually had to use this at work, so I have it fresh. You have 1, you have 2x minus 1, you have 6x squared minus 6x plus 1. You have 20x cubed minus 30x squared plus 12x minus 1. And those are functions that are completely orthogonal to each other. You know, it makes the coefficients, when you want to express functions in, like, you know, third grade polynomials, you can just use four numbers, and those four numbers are very independent from each other, you know. It makes math a lot easier. Well, spherical harmonics are like this, but in the sphere. You know, basically there are a set of basis functions that are orthogonal. And then instead of being addressed by one number, they're addressed by a direction in the sphere, which is kind of two-dimensional. Okay? They are the equivalent of a cube map in many ways. A cube map is a function of the sphere. You give it a direction, and they give you back some value. Spherical harmonics is a set of coefficients that apply to some special functions, which are orthogonal and have very, very nice properties. One of them is that if you have a rotation matrix, you can actually rotate the entire function very easily just by operating on the coefficients. Let me show you one thing that I need my mouse. Just one example of, you know, the main reason why they get used in lighting formulas. Okay. So switch to duplicate. There. So Direct3D 9. This is all the samples that they have for Direct3D 9. And this is a neat one. It's called a PRT demo. PRT, pre-computed radiance transfer. And it's a way of doing lighting that's interesting. So this lighting comes from an environment map, so to speak. So it's like this background scene, which is, kind of like the scene from a forest, you know, with trees and the house over there, is lighting this object here. Okay. And he's lighting it in a, you know, with a diffuse model. This is just a diffuse model right here. But it's a model that allows you to specify light coming from everywhere, kind of arbitrarily. You know, like there's a light bulb over there, and the sun is over there, and, you know, there's a white floor, so light is reflecting up from it. You know, if you can express that in a cube map, it allows you to light every point of the object using all the accumulation of all those lights. You know, like a continuous of light. And not only that, it allows you to specify at each point in the object how much light it gets from every direction. And that includes blockers. Like, for instance, you see that there is a darker part over here. That's because the light that's coming from here, which is a lot, you can see it's bright here, it doesn't actually reach here because it's being blocked. It's a little bit, you know, that's a little bit of shadowing. The only gotcha about this is that this has to be as a rigid object. You can't have a, you know, like a character use this and say, oh, you know, the arm is kind of shadowing the chest because it's over here. Okay, that would require recomputing those coefficients for the spherical harmonics at every point in a texture, that sort of thing, which can be complex, can be costly. Okay, and it's also kind of low frequency, so you don't really see the outline of this here. Okay, you just see like a blur of a shadow. Okay, but it looks quite nice, you know, nicer than just Lambert. Okay, and it's based on this spherical harmonics. It's based on the fact that the spherical harmonics allow you to represent any function of the sphere, that doing a convolution of two of them, you know, it's just a dot product of the coefficients. The convolution is basically what you do in order to say, hey, that light that comes from over there, you know, I only see like 20% of it. Light that comes over there, you know, I see 50% of it, and so on and so forth. Taking into account blockers and also the normals, you know, in basically a model like Lambert. Yes?
Well, what's being decomposed into spherical harmonics? Is it the light from the environment?
It's two things. It's the light from the environment. So this cube map is being turned into a spherical harmonic representation. And also, there is a texture that contains coefficients of spherical harmonics. And that texture is being applied to the entire object. And those coefficients expressed at every point in the surface of this object, by having those coefficients in the components of a texture, those coefficients at every point, you know, accumulate things like the normal at that point, accumulate things as to, you know, what is blocking the light from every direction falling into that point. And in the end, the lighting equation in the pixel shader is just taking a series of coefficients that were sampled from a texture and the coefficients from the light source, which are shader constants, and doing a dot product between the two.
Now it says technique N dot L, would that be Lambert shading?
Yeah. Yes. So, let's see, where was this? Oh, here. Yeah. So this is kind of what Lambert looks like. In this case, with the light coming from here. One direction. Okay, remember, the other one is light coming from everywhere. All around. And this one is just without any shadowing. It's just saying, hey, you know, I have a normal, right? And an environment, the light is expressed as a spherical harmonics, and it's just sampling from it. You know, saying, oh, you know, just what I'm getting is the light from that direction. I don't remember what this was exactly. And then, so, anyway, it's just, you know, to show that sometimes, you know, strange math turns into very cheap pixel shaders that can do lighting per pixel in interesting ways. And again, you know, this takes quite a lot of studying and learning in order to get it to implement correctly. But I want you to be aware of all these things, at the very least. Questions? So far, I mean, well. Well, there's actually another sample that's kind of neat to look at. So this one is also pre-computed radiance transfer, okay? This one shows a slightly different thing. So this one doesn't do any real shadowing. Maybe the ears kind of shadow over here. But as the wings move, they don't cast shadows on the bat, right? Because when you pre-compute those things, you know, you can only pre-compute them in one pose of the model, not all of them. At least not easily. But with a pre-computed Reynolds transfer, because it's a spherical harmonics function, it's a function on the entire sphere, not just the hemisphere that's above the surface at every point. Remember, you have a surface, you know, above that surface there is a hemisphere, only half of the sphere. The other half is underneath. It would be light that comes through the object. You know, it kind of comes out that way instead of being reflected. The thing is, you know, there are some materials like the wings of a bat that do that. You know, another one is, you know, your skin is kind of transparent. You can shine a flashlight on one side of your hand and you'll see red on the other side. Just light coming through your hand. So, in this case, what you have is a bat that's letting some light through. And that's expressed just in the spherical harmonics. It just basically says, hey, you know, if there's light on the other side, then I get some of it. That's what it says. So, regular Lambert would look like this. It's just still pretty nice. You know, this is using a normal map. Clearly. But this is basically what you get with Lambert. Okay? Light is coming from one direction, and in the other direction, you get shadow. Okay? With this PRT, it basically expresses light that is bouncing on the skin, also light that's coming through the skin. Just by virtue of it being like one tiny little cube map at every pixel of the texture of that object. It's an approximation of a cube map. But it's much better than nothing. Okay. Yeah. Of course, when you have one of those spherical harmonics, you have a set of coefficients per component of the color, right? So it's like, oh, red comes from here, there, and green from there. You know, it's just a different function for each component. They're independent from each other. Anyway. Okay. There are some characteristics of it, like, you know, that you can choose either one coefficient of 4 or 9 or 16. You can't do, like, 7. Okay. Doesn't work as well. Just because it's, like, three-dimensional kind of thing, and it just ends up having that particularity.
It's the number of coefficients that must be in the
square. Yep. Okay. Okay, let's go on to physics, which is a lot more applicable, but still kind of interesting when you really get into it. So, how do you do physics? One way is to have a formula for how your physical objects move. You know, the most classical one is the ballistic trajectories, which are parabolas. So, ballistic trajectories are typically expressed as, I have a gun, right, which shoots a bullet Okay, and it should tuple at starting at some point. That's P0. Okay. And it shoots the bullet at some velocity, initial velocity. Okay. And then the bullet starts flying. Okay. The gun is not doing anything more to the bullet, right? It's only gravity that's affecting it. And drag, but let's ignore that for a moment. Okay. So there's gravity. So that bullet, what happens is it describes a parabola. Okay. Eventually it falls because it's being pulled down by gravity. And the trajectory is a parabola. And it has a formula. You know, if position is expressed in meters and velocity, here it's expressed in meters per second. And the acceleration is expressed in meters per second squared. And T, which is time, is expressed in seconds, right? Everything kind of in the same coherent set of units. Then this is the position that you get at time T. After 3 seconds, it will be here. And it works. You can use that. But of course, you know, just moving things with gravity exclusively, gets boring after a time. Okay. So people want to express more interesting things. Like wind, like drag, like springs. Springs are an interesting building block for physical things like simulating clothes, like a cape of a superhero, for instance. You know, it's built like a whole bunch of tiny little micro springs. And those things, what they do is make these acceleration be kind of not constant anymore. Okay, it depends on many, many factors. So we use this other type of method, which is a method of numerical integration. We take some time step, say one frame, say 1/60th of a second, or 16.66666 milliseconds. Just a short interval of time. And, you know, for every frame, I just do this. You know, increment the position by the velocity times that time step, and then I increment the velocity by the acceleration times that time step. And now I can calculate a different acceleration every frame. It doesn't have to be constant. If I keep it constant, this describes a parabola. So this method is what's called Euler integration. It's the simplest way to numerically calculate physics. One step at a time, one frame at a time. Okay? The simplest way. If you want the real mathematical interpretation of this Euler integration, you know, it's just that this is differential equations, and you have them here in case you care about those things. When you have differential equations, you solve them by integrating them. Okay. In general, the acceleration will depend on where the bullet is, right? I mean, imagine a plane crossing the jet stream. Jet stream, you know, is a very, very fast wind up there in the skies. But it's only in certain places, right? Not everywhere. So it will depend on the disposition, it'll depend on the velocity, it'll depend on the time, you know. Forces can vary over time too. Okay. Questions? Okay. There's a little more detail on, you know, how to calculate forces. So, and you know, here you have a few formulas. Like you can have the constant force of gravity, okay, which is constant, and it's constant as an acceleration. Okay, if you are heavier, then the Earth has more power over you. Okay, if you're lighter, then the earth doesn't pull quite so far, so strongly. Okay, but the acceleration is always constant. A spring is one example of a force that depends on the position. Imagine that I have a wall and I attach one end of a spring. Okay. And then I have a handle here and I take that spring and pull from it. The further that I pull, the stronger the spring will be trying to pull back. Okay. And it also works the other way. If I push it, the farther that I push it in towards the wall, the stronger it will push back. Okay. There is a position at which it wants me to stay. Okay. So, and that's this C position. And this is where I have it. And this expresses the force. You know, this K is just some constant. If it's bigger, then it means the spring is stronger. That's all. Okay. So, forces can also depend on velocity, and drag is one of them. I mean, if you've ever, tried punching water, like in the pool or in the ocean, okay, you can just get your hand in, and it doesn't pose any resistance. But if you punch it, okay, you will feel it, okay, because the force that it exerts on you is bigger. Depends on the velocity. And the formula is kind of like that. Force is always against the direction of movement. If I'm moving towards that window, then the air that I'm going through is pushing back. It's drag. And again, K is just some constant, you know, depending on, I mean, water has more drag than air, right? So that's what expresses that. The time-dependent forces could be winds. I mean, you know, you're here and suddenly there's a gust of wind and then it stops. Changes over time. And that could be any function. I mean, it's just, there is no specific function that says how wind changes over time. Right?
You could probably do something for wind or as a function of the plane speed and air pressure.
Oh yeah, I mean, if you're gonna make a flight simulator kind of game, then you're gonna play with all sorts of things like this, right? I mean, plane lift, there's also forces that depend on the velocity and the angle of attack and things like that. Oh yeah. I mean, if you ever study aerodynamics, you know, it's all about this. It's all about the forces exerted on the plane or the car or the tank. I don't know if people study aerodynamics on tanks, but maybe.
Okay.
Yeah. And hey, you know, a tank that's more aerodynamic will go faster, or will use less gas, or, I don't know. Of course. They probably do. So there are other ways of integrating, okay? Euler is okay, except it does things like this. If the normal formula would have the bullet describe a trajectory like this one, with Euler integration, it'll actually go on the outside, typically. The reason is that what we're doing is we're saying, okay, so the bullet is here, and this is the velocity, right? It's going in that direction, and this much, okay? So, after one time step, say, because the bullet is actually going very, very fast, coming out of the gun, right? Maybe this is how, where it ends, right? After one tiny fraction of a second. That's what we calculate with Euler. Remember, it's just velocity times some delta. Okay? But the thing is, velocity is actually being affected by gravity constantly. Right? It's not just 60 times per second. Okay? It's continuous. So, the bullet will start falling immediately. But with Euler integration, it doesn't start falling until the second frame, right? So it will actually just go straight for the first frame and will end up higher than it would have otherwise. And this error will accumulate. I mean, next frame, it'll calculate the correct new velocity. Like, you know, the bullet would have been here and would have been going in that direction. So it says, yep, that's the velocity. It's going that way. But again, it just does one time step. So it keeps diverging further from the original path. Okay, it's an error. Guaranteed. The only thing you can do is make it smaller by making it smaller time steps. Let's say every frame, we make the time step 1/10 of a frame, and we do it 10 times. It'll be more precise, but it'll still diverge. Still accumulate error all the time. There's a method which is like this, okay, in which I not only move by this velocity, but say, hey, you know, and the acceleration on average will affect this velocity by, you know, half of that time step. So, you know, this midpoint method, what it says is, if my velocity now is this, and next frame is going to be like that, then I'm going to take the average of the two velocities, which is something like this. That's what I'm going to use. So from here it says, oh, it's going this way. And we'll end up a lot closer. Okay. In fact, from ballistics, you know, it actually ends up in the right place.
Oh, because the acceleration is positive.
Yep. Actually, I'm beginning to think there is a delta t squared over here, maybe. I'll have to check the math. Yeah. I will have to check the math. I'm not entirely certain right now.
But the least,
yeah. So the idea is that the velocity that we'll have on the second frame and the velocity that we have this frame, you know, we just take the average and use that as the velocity. You know, that's the idea of the midpoint. And it's a better way of integrating. With purely ballistic trajectories, it's actually kind of perfect. Okay, it just so happens. It is still an approximation in general. But it behaves way better. And it's kind of simple. Even if I didn't do it quite right. Okay, questions? Okay. This is the model load. Okay. Runge-Kutta integration. So it is said that the Euler integration is like Runge-Kutta of degree 0, and midpoint is Runge-Kutta of degree 1, or 1 and 2. Actually, 1 and 2. And this is Runge-Kutta of degree 4. Okay, and it's a whole bunch of extra calculations. Okay. In many ways, you know, intuitively, what this thing is saying is, okay, so I'm gonna go like this, and the next frame I'll go like that. So let's assume that I take, you know, I start precisely with this new velocity. But I only do a half a step. Instead of a full step, only a half a step. And then figure out where I would end up. Okay? And then go back and try again, you know, basically with a more refined type. You know, basically it refines it in four steps. Saying, oh, you know, now I'm going that direction, but then I will be going in that direction. So, you know, I'm going to try something a little bit in between and then rinse and repeat, right? And find something even closer, okay? The Runge CUDA of degree 4, you know, is generally thought as a very good compromise between performance and stability of the algorithm. Okay. When you don't have a good algorithm, bad things happen, like, you know, if you have ever played a game and you've seen that there's a body on the floor and it's twitching and it never stops, right? Or even, you know, your math, you know, it starts twitching even more and more and more over time and just eventually disappears or something like that. You know, that's bad integration, always. Okay. And that's what better algorithms try to avoid. This is computationally expensive because not only does it run Euler integrations multiple times and then have to do a weighted average between them, it also has to calculate the forces, the accelerations, multiple times. It says, oh, I go here and then, you know, what's the force then? You know, and then it uses that in order to figure out, oh, so maybe my velocity, initial velocity should be more like this and more like that, you know, and so it calculates the acceleration multiple times. Okay. And of course, you know, there is even more degrees, you know, like 10 or 2 million. Of course, people just, you know, tend to limit themselves to 4 as a good compromise. Okay, questions? All right, let's do 10 minutes until, you know, 10 to 8. Yes, and please sign in if you haven't. Yes, I answered that.
Oh, I haven't checked my email.
Yeah. Yeah, okay. Okay. Thank you for calling me in. Oh, sorry. It is freakish and hard to understand, and you can even see images of what the functions look like, but even then you don't really get it, how they work.
In terms of pixel shape, is it just like running a certain function at every pixel then that you define to it?
Yeah.
Just assume it works. Like,
yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
So like...
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, it's just a set of coefficients that represent the function. If you want a different function per pixel, then you put the coefficients in a texture, right? And then when you sample from the texture, you get the coefficients for that particular pixel. Mm-hmm. They work very well in there because the basis functions that they apply to, those coefficients, are orthogonal, which means they're completely independent from each other. Meaning things like the bilinear filtering of those coefficients, you know, it does actually exactly what you expect it to do. It gives you an interpolation between the two functions, you know. So it's just a very nice way of expressing the same thing that you could express with a cube map, which is a little easier to visualize. I mean, that background scene was a cube map, right? You know, you could see some trees and a house and things like that. You know, an image that envelops the entire sphere around you. You know, every direction, up, down, left, right, front, back, everything. So the spherical harmonics is like saying, oh, I have a texture, but instead of having all the pixels, you know, I just have a few coefficients that apply to certain magic functions, give me an approximation. the more coefficients you have, the more detail can you have in your image. You know, if you have 1,000 coefficients for spherical harmonics, you can probably make out houses and trees and everything just by calculating a function. Of course, a function will be expensive. So you use those when you, when just a few coefficients is enough. For instance, for lighting, you know, if I have a light bulb over there, the spherical harmonics are going to say that I get a lot of light from there, not quite so much light from there, not quite so much light from there, but, you know, it kind of blurs out, you know, it's low frequency, it's blurred out, low definition, kind of, you know, light. That's one of the properties of it being an orthogonal basis. Orthogonal basis means that, you know, you take one of those basis functions, just one of them, okay, and then sample from your cube map, say, okay, and you say, oh, what's the light over there? And what do I get from the basis function over there? And multiply them together. And then accumulate that in multiple directions. You can do it randomly or, you know, like equal grid or something like that. So you just sample multiple times and just accumulate those samples. You know, the more you have, you know, the better the end result will fit your data. Okay? And because they are orthogonal, it means that you calculate each individual coefficient just by using the basis function that it applies to in isolation from all the other coefficients and all the other basis functions, which makes things easy. That's because it's orthogonal. It's one of the big properties of it. Okay? So, again, probably this doesn't quite clear up your mind about it. You know, it typically takes, you know, using this multiple times and actually working with it for a long time. Of course, you know, in a 10-week course, I can't do that. I can only tell you about it and hope that somebody finds it useful. Okay. But, yeah, I mean, I just did it recently. You know, there's this game and they were using textures, very low resolution textures. And I needed to optimize because they were thrashing the texture cache of the GPU. What it did was turn it into basis functions and coefficients. Basically, I turned each texture into 8 coefficients of, you know, basis functions like those. You know, that's how I got those, just by working it out. And it worked. Worked fine. All right. Let's continue. First things first, there's still people here who have not signed in. You're here, Robbie. Okay. And Daniel. Okay, maybe not. So I already explained lesson number one about animation. What is an animation?
Something that changes over time.
Something that changes over time. Somebody's position, somebody's orientation, somebody's size. Okay? Something that pulsates bigger and smaller. You can animate the size of things. Some color that changes. You know, my eyes glow bright and then not, and then bright and then not. Okay. So we're always going to be saying that we animate one value, independent from anything else that we might be animating at the time. Okay. If I am animating Bruce Lee doing his thing, like whatever, you know. We're going to say that we're animating just, you know, the tip of this pinky. I know that Bruce Lee is moving every single bone in his body, but, you know, every bone is independent from each other when it comes to the actual animation. They're put together when we apply that animation to a skeleton and a skin and things like that. And we'll talk about that, but not today. However, there are some things like rotations where we can't, I mean, we could animate like three angles. Say, you know, we're animating, you know, the gun in a warship, right? Those guns typically have a rotation and then elevation, right? And we can animate those separately. But if we're animating an airplane that's just doing loopy-de-loops and all sorts of acrobatics, for instance, then we can't just say, oh, we're just animating this angle and then this other one. Okay, we need to animate the actual orientation of the plane as one single element. And that's where we do slurps and things like that. Okay, and we just treat it as if it were one single value. That we can operate on, and we just operate on it intelligently. Excuse me, intelligently, smartly. So, but you know, for the purpose of the rest of this entire slide deck, you know, we're just gonna assume one single value, a float, a number, a real number, okay, that we're gonna animate, so it goes up and down. Now it's 0, then it's 1, then it's 13, and then it's negative 2. Okay? So the first thing to understand is that usually when we animate things, we're interpolating. And this is very similar to like interpolation in a texture. Remember bilinear interpolation, bilinear filtering or point filtering, that sort of thing. Point filtering is just saying, oh, I just take the closest value, right? I'm not going to do any math on it. You know, I have an animation store that has a series of values that it changes over time, and I'm just going to take the closest. The next step is linear interpolation. And for that, I'm saying, oh, if I'm animating at this point in time, I'm going to give this value here, which is just the linear interpolation between those two. I do it as a lerp between x0 and x1, and the third parameter of the lerp is the percentage. You know, the it is 0 at T0 and 1 at T1. Okay. But of course we can extrapolate. That's what you get when you apply a lerp and you give that third parameter that is not between 0 and 1. It means you're interpolating outside of the range. Like here. And that is perfectly valid. It has applications. It has uses. But it's to be used only when we just do not have any more data beyond this T1, say. And we still need something. Then we have to extrapolate. Okay? One place where this is done a lot is when you have networked games. When you extrapolate in the future, you know, beyond all the data that you have, what you're doing is predicting. Doing a best guess as to where something is going to be at that future time that we have no data for. When you have games being played over the network, you know, the ping, the lag, will actually, you know, can actually be very significant and can affect your gameplay. So games typically start predicting and extrapolating in order to compensate for that lag. And that introduces error, but reduces the lag that the player perceives. So there's a balance to be made there. Okay? Yeah, I don't care. I care a lot about networking, but I don't deal with it. It's actually one of the fields in games that I have dealt with the least professionally. I mean, I know quite a bit about how it's done, but I have no practical expertise of it. You know, on it, I'm maybe closer to the way you are with graphics right now. You know, I have my head full of stuff, but I don't know how to do it. Not really. So when I have a whole bunch of values, you know, I have a movie of a ballerina moving around, and, you know, part of it is a whole bunch of values, you know, the ballerina is dancing for a minute, you know, then I have a minute of values of one of her pinkies moving. Okay, say. Then one thing that I can do is just find the two closest ones and, you know, do a linear interpolation in between those two. You know, I want a value right here, like, you know, T2.5, and then I get something here. Because I use these two values that I have, and I invent one in the middle. Best guess. Okay? It is very simple, and in many cases, this is good enough. You don't need to do anything more special than this. Okay? If your values here, you have them every 30th of a second, say, linear interpolation between them is probably perfect. If your values here are every second, then maybe linear interpolation is not quite so perfect. Okay? Then you start wanting to do things like this. You don't want to have those sharp corners there. You know, sudden changes of velocity. You know, that feels a little bit like a fly. You ever observed a fly flying? You know, it goes like this, and then, you know, it does like, you know, sharp turns, like instantaneous turn. Doo, 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 doo. Okay. So, it is more pleasant to the eye if the fly were doing something like this. Describing curves instead of sharp, you know, straight lines with sharp angles. One very typical way of doing this is to use third-degree polynomials, cubic interpolation. The reason is that a cubic has four coefficients to it, whereas a linear interpolation has two. Linear interpolation actually looks like this. A cubic has four different coefficients to it. That allows me to have four constraints on my functions. We want them to link up. Like, you know, I have one function here, another one here, another one here, another one here, and I want it to be on the same spot in T2 on both sides. We already have that with linear. But linear is the only thing you can do. Make sure that both segments meet up at the right point. With a cubic, you can also make it so that the velocity doesn't change as you switch from one function to the other. So you have two points and two velocities to match. And that's four constraints that gives us four coefficients.
Is there also continuity and acceleration in this? Continuity and acceleration?
No. In this case, there is no continuity of anything else, but the positions, you know, they do not disappear from one place and start a different place. Continuity of the positions, and continuity of the velocities. It doesn't do sharp turns. But if you want more, then you need more coefficients and, you know, bigger degrees of polynomials. Nobody uses more than cubic for this purpose. Okay. It is more complex than linear, but it's also quite simple, and it is very, very effective. The way this is done typically, again, is by figuring out, you know, in what velocity it goes at the two points. In this case, we're interpolating between T1 and T2. Okay. And we can just express what velocity we want at those two points and what position we want it to be, and from that we can extract the four coefficients of the cubic polynomial that gives us the implementation, and that's what's called Hermite interpolation. Okay, when what we have is the positions and the velocities that we want. There's another method, which is Catmull-Rom. You know, it's just a name, some people that came up with it. And in this case, it doesn't actually express the velocities, but it uses the adjacent points to figure out what the most likely velocity is going to be. So in this case, it says, oh, you know, if I were to move straight from this point to this point, this would be the velocity. So I'm going to say that that's the velocity in the middle. Point in between. So same thing with those two. This is the same velocity. Okay. Again, you have functions in D3DX that do those calculations. You can find them in literature and on the internet in multiple places. You only need to look for the names, right? Which is one good reason to know those names. This cubic can actually be done as a series of lerts. So if you say, you know, this A, right, it's the lerp, you know, would be the percentage within this interval, right? The thing that we would use with lerp if we were doing linear interpolation. So if we interpolate between T0 and T1 with a factor of this percentage plus 1, we're actually extrapolating where it would be if we were using these two points for interpolation here, you know, for extrapolation. So this is an extrapolation, this is an interpolation, this is linear, this is another extrapolation in the past. You know, if we were using these two points, where would it be? You know. So it's basically using all these things, and then these two, which are dependent on those, and then a final one. So just a chain of linear interpolations that are codependent gives us the same result as a cubic spline. The nice thing about that is if you have slurp, you can do this with quaternions. You can do cubic interpolation with quaternions. Okay. In this case, this is the equivalent of Cadmo-Rom because it uses the two adjacent points. Okay. The thing is, nobody does so many slurps, just to animate one single value, one single rotation, because they can be complicated because of all the corner cases that I talked about. So typically people, animation systems will use linear interpolation instead for rotations. Maybe they will use cubic interpolation for positions. It doesn't have to be the same system for all the values that are animating at the same time. Okay. Because linear interpolation, when you have all the value, all the intermediate values, linear interpolation is actually quite sufficient. If you have like 30 frames of animation per second stored in memory, then you can linear interpolate between them, no problem. The thing is, with animations, that's a lot of memory, right? If you need to animate all the rotations of all the phalanges, of all the fingers, plus, the arms and the feet, and the clothing, maybe, of somebody who's moving around, that can be a lot of data, 30 times per second, or 60 times per second. So it is also quite common to simplify this data. I mean, look at this interpolation that we've been seeing in several slides. Okay. There is one point that's kind of redundant there. It just doesn't really add much to the overall look of this animation. Can you spot the point? The point at T1, which is X1. Okay. It's kind of like, if you were doing linear interpolation between those two, you'd get something very close. I mean, this one is very significant, right? Because it differs a lot from something like a linear interpolation between those two, right? But this one is right in the midpoint. I mean, so you can eliminate it. You could eliminate it. And say, hey, just find the two closest ones and interpolate between them. There are things that break down a little bit when you do this, which is you can't quite use Cadmo-Rom anymore because it requires that the adjacent points and the two points are the same distance apart in time. But, if you're doing this as a pre-processing, then you say you have your animation with all the frames and then you go through it and figure out which points do not really add anything to the animation. You could just remove and let them be interpolated. Then you can also pre-calculate all the coefficients for every segment, for instance, and things like that. Okay. Or just leave it and, just do linear interpolation and then just eliminate those points that, look to be kind of superfluous if you do linear interpolation only. Which in this case, this one is probably a good candidate anyway. Okay.
Is it typical to, if you
you could just calculate that the velocities at every point when you have all of the points, right? And then just eliminate the points that don't really make sense and just keep this point which is with its velocity. You also have to store the time stamp for every point. Because now they're not at regular intervals. you know, you actually need that piece of data. So you need to add data, but you're also removing data. The hope is that you're removing more than you're adding. The hope is that you're removing a lot of points. The thing is, when you have 30 frames per second, you know, things don't like change sharply within a 30th of a second, typically. No. Okay. Questions? Yes.
So I vaguely remember John Lasseter speaking about this a long time ago, and he gives an example from the Luxor Junior Shorts. And I thought maybe he had three key, one scene where the little guy jumps up and it just had three key points. The starting position, the midpoint, and bottom. If you do this, will it kind of just go, and then, or will it give more of a parabola?
Well, if you do linear interpolation, then you get a sharp turn at the top, right? If you have, you know, that little lamp jumping, so you have a first point on the ground, another one up in the air, and then the third one when it touches the ground again, then if you do linear interpolation, it's going to go like this, and then poof. It's like it's bouncing in the air, right? So no, I mean, what you do is you use things like, cubic interpolation. In which case, you know, you're doing something like this. Because if you're using something like Catmull ROM type interpolation, then, you know, the velocity at the top, you know, is horizontal, right? It's the equivalent as the interpolation between the two points on the other extremes.
So that's one case where instead of having 30 or 40 or whatever, you have 3.
Yeah. And, hey, you know, it could take a second for, you know, the thing to jump and fall back down. And in 1 second is 3 keyframes, right? So, and that's pretty good savings in animation. Also, you know, animators, when they use animation packages, you know, typically... don't define every single frame. That's like micromanaging. That's like drawing an image one pixel at a time. You know, people don't do that. Okay. What people do is use something like the airbrush tool to just say, you know, and the keyframe is a little bit like that. It's basically saying, oh, you know, I just want at this point to be like this and, you know, please machine, you know, figure out what the rest should be. And if it's not good, then I'll add another keyframe to refine the animation. So quite often, you know, actually animators will create their animations using keyframes. The thing is, your game might not be using the same keyframing system or interpolation system that than the animator, you know, the animation package is using. You might not even know exactly what they're doing. Okay. So it is also very common for tools to extract that animation from the package, you know, basically extract all the frames that the package interpolates, and then, you know, the tool will examine all those frames and then eliminate the ones that it feels like will be superfluous once that animation is replayed inside of the game.
So,
you know, using the math that's implemented in the game. So if the game uses linear interpolation, then it'll basically introduce keyframes. You know, in effect, you know, it will end up introducing keyframes in order to keep the same smooth path than the original within whatever margin of error. That makes sense to people, more or less.
And that's fine because that's all pre-processing. As all pre-processing, so that's fine.
Yeah, I mean, when you are, have like offline tools, sometimes you can have it work on it for a day, right? I mean, that's how Pixar does the movies, right? They don't render in real time. You know, they take an hour per frame in order to make it super pretty. You know, they have lots of math going on that frame to figure out exactly, you know, how to make it look the best, right? Well, this is no different. You know, you can have a program of yours chew an animation for a day in order to make it perfect for the game. Of course, you know, you need a good algorithm that does that chewing, right? And animations never take that long to operate on. You know, images are a lot more data than animations. Okay.
So what is the primary reason for this is to save memory?
It is to save, well, yeah, to save memory. If you don't care about memory, then the easiest is to have 30 frames stored in there per second and just do linear interpolation. That's the simplest.
With memory going the way it is that realistic, or do they trade off for more?
It is realistic. It all depends on how much animation you need, you know, what's the amount of space that you have on the disk, on storage, what's the amount of space that you have in memory, what's the bandwidth of reading from disk into memory. I mean, hey, you know, you could store 1,000 frames per second in order to make it super perfect. You don't even need to interpolate. You know, like, just picking the closest would be fine if you store 1,000 frames per second. But the thing is, you know, where do you put your line? You know, your stick on the ground saying, you know, this is enough. You always have a choice, always. But, you know, there are ways to go overboard both ways. You could say, oh, I'm not going to do animations. Yeah, I'm not going to do keyframes. I'm going to figure out a grade 1000 polygon that's going to evaluate to my entire animation. You could do that. Nobody does that because it's very expensive to compute such a polygon. You know, it just takes forever. I mean, every frame, come on. For every pinky? No.
So the game engine gets the keyframes.
Yeah.
And then
the game engine, what it gets typically is an array of structures, and structure has a timestamp and a value, or maybe so there are also choices, like, you know, you're animating a character. That character has, say, 100 bones, 100 different moving parts that animate. I mean, if you're animating all hands, that's a lot of bones, okay? If you're animating the face, there are many moving parts in a face. If you're animating muscles, you know, so that they can do those things that they do with the pectorals and things like that, or with the biceps, you know, so it bulges, things like that. I mean, you can go really crazy. I mean, on the Xbox One, I worked on this game, which was universally considered one of the really bad games, unfortunately, but the animation engine was awesome because I did it. It was Bruce Lee Quest of the Dragon. You might have heard of it or not, seen it or not. The thing is, one of the things it needed to do was portray Bruce Lee so that he's very recognizable. You know, with all the nuances of movements that he did and everything. So he needed a very, very detailed animation engine. And, you know, I was the guy who did that animation engine, and I'm extremely proud of it. You know, on the original Xbox, the thing had more than 100 bones on that character. I mean, they didn't fit in the constants of the vertex shader. We had to split the model so that different parts, were moved, you know, with a limited number of moving parts. So one arm, and then the other arm, and then the head, and then the body, and then the legs, that sort of thing.
Now, would you tend to?
Just 1 second. One other thing to consider is, do you store each individual moving part as a keyframed animation with its own set of timestamps? Or do you have one set of timestamps and then values for all the different bones in the body? And again, that's your choice. If you have individual timestamps per bone, then you're gonna have to find the interpolation formula individually for each bone. If the timestamps are common to all the bones, then maybe this bone is really not moving much between these two keyframes. So, you know, I could eliminate one of them, but they keep it because other bones are moving. in more interesting ways between those two keyframes, that sort of thing. Okay. So it basically simplifies the math in the game, so it goes faster, but it uses, and it uses, potentially more memory because I need more keyframes. Because if one pinky is moving interestingly, maybe I need that keyframe, even if the rest of the body is completely static. And I need the data for all the bones repeated, even if it doesn't move. So, everything is a choice.
You can tell your animators don't do the one pinky.
Yeah, but then they say, but I need to, because that's what looks good. Because that's what Bruce Lee does. He goes like this. Maybe. Well, not like this, you know, he went kind of like... But the rest of the body is not moving, right? It's just like this. Come get it. Okay? So again, it's all a balance of how much memory you're spending, how much pre-processing time you want to spend. Maybe you don't want to have a farm of computers working overnight for a month in order to get everything chewed up. You know, how much performance you want to spend in the game, how much memory.
Usually this the keyframe the animation computation is done in the shaders or in the
normally it's done in the CPU. Mm-hmm. Usually what happens is the CPU calculates all the orientations, and we'll talk about skeletal animation and hierarchical animations and that sort of thing next week. But yeah, normally the CPU will chew through all of that and generate a whole bunch of matrices or quaternions, you know, but usually it's easier for shaders to just do matrices. So unless you need the space, you know, because quaternions are cheaper, they're smaller, you know, you just figure out the matrices and then give them to the shader. And the vertex shader will take those matrices and move the vertices using those vertices. It's like, you know, having one model have a whole bunch of world matrices, you know, which is basically what you calculate when you animate something that's moving. Again, you know, you can animate colors, you can animate all sorts of things, but texture coordinates, you know, for the conveyor belts. And, okay, other questions? Right. So again, this is just strategies to create an animation to move a value, right? Just to be able to express how a value moves. And that's for pre-canned animations, okay? The type that an artist prepares in some tool like, you know, Maya or 3D Studio Max or this Messiah thing that I sent the email about. Okay? Those are animations where artists create those animations. Those are packages to create animations. Of course, you know, there are many types of animations that are just moved by physics or just by esoteric math of one kind or another. Mm. One of the most classical ones is the particle systems. That's the last topic, and it's actually the topic of the homework for this week. So particle systems, you know, use a math that is basically physics. So we've already seen it. You know, we're going to see a little more how it applies to the particle systems. Particle systems are just saying, hey, you know, there is something like water. I want to animate water. You know, I have the ocean. I want to animate it. So how do you do it? How do you express water? Right? There are various different ways. One way is saying, oh, I'm just gonna express the surface of the water. So that's like a two-dimensional grid that moves. So it creates ripples and waves and things like that. You know, that's one way. And, you know, as you saw in one of the games, Halo that we were looking at, the other day, there was a scene with the ocean in the background, and that ocean was a surface. and it had ripples in it, you know, but it was basically a surface. And that's how they modeled water. But there is actually all sorts of ways in which you can model water. I mean, with just a surface, you cannot model water coming out of a fire hose. You know, it just doesn't work. Okay. I mean, you can approximate it. Maybe you can say, oh, you know, there's like a tube of water coming out of the fire hose, but it's kind of hard to animate. I mean, there's some point at which it breaks apart. Okay. How do you express rain? You know, that really does not work as a surface, right? It's water. But the approximation of using a surface does not really apply to it at all whatsoever. So particle systems is one way to express sort of organic things, you know, things that are not solid, that are not expressible as a mesh of triangles. Things like rain, snow, things like smoke and fire. Clouds. Yes.
Would you also say fractals or
fractal light? Fractals. Well, fractals are just mathematical thingies that are self-repeating. So they can be applied for trees, for instance. But ultimately, when you render a tree, you're not rendering a fractal. You're rendering a mesh of triangles. Maybe you use the fractal to generate it. But in the end, you just have a mesh of triangles. You know, a fractal is a mathematical tool.
Right.
It's not a way to, you know, represent real things.
Well, I was
not
just
directly.
Thinking that instead of using the word organic, you use the word fractal. Like, maybe not.
Yeah, particles are more like, you know, to express something fluid. You know, it's what is used to represent sparks coming out of a, you know, the end of an exposed wire, for instance. You know, you ever see that in games? You know, there's dangling wire and it goes like, and sparks come out. You know, those are expressed as particles. And people have used particles for fluid simulations. So they say, hey, you know, water is a whole bunch of billions of molecules of water moving with each other. But let's assume it's only about, you know, a few hundred, you know, because it's a more manageable number. And it's an approximation. But then they say, let's apply the real physics formulas of how water molecules interact with each other to those bigger things. And what they find out is that they can actually make that look kind of like water. And they do, like, fluid simulations with them. So they can create, for instance, a canalization, right? Like those curvy tiles in some roofs, or like an aqueduct, or like a, you know, something kind of like that that basically drives water down the side of a mountain and goes left and right and things like that. And they can actually, you know, if they do things right, you know, by expressing water as a bunch of individual particles, like big molecules that interact with each other, they can actually make it so that those particles move down through that canalization, kind of like water would do. So they splash when they turn and do things like that. Okay. And of course, you know, the more particles you have, the better the simulation. And there are limits to what computers can do and all that. You know, of course, in games, you typically don't do it so precisely because, you know, there is only very limited computation time. We need everything to be real time, right? But particles, when they're just a bunch, you know, they can be very, very, very easy to implement, especially when they don't interact with each other, like molecules of water do, right? Typically, when you have particle systems, they are independent from each other. And nowadays, modern GPUs can actually do the simulation in the GPU because GPUs are very, very good parallel machines. With Direct3D 11 compute shaders or NVIDIA CUDA shaders, you know, you can do those types of particle simulations very easily. And they run in the GPU, and maybe you can have thousands or even millions of particles. As long as they're independent from each other. Interactions are what makes it very complicated. So, anyway, usually it's just a simple physics simulation. You know, the particle is assumed to have some small mass. Typically, you know, it's like all particles have the same mass, and, you know, there's no different mass. So, like, force is the same as acceleration. You know, just, there's just a constant between them. Each particle stores things like its position and its velocity. You know, as vectors, right? X, Y, Z position. And X, Y, Z velocity. You know, which direction and how fast it's going. If different particles have different mass, then maybe you would store that. But again, it's not very typical. Particles typically have an age. I mean, you don't want a particle that's going to be there after 2 hours of gameplay. Okay? Particles have to be very, very fleeting. Because particle systems change, right? You know, you have one explosion here, and then another one here, and then another one here. And then they dissipate and disappear, those explosions, because you need the memory and the computation power for the next explosion, right? You know, you need to free up everything as quickly as possible. So typically you have an age. You know, particles eventually die. Sometimes they don't need the age because particles are only moved by gravity. So you say when they hit the floor, they disappear. And then suddenly you don't need age. But conceptually they need something like an age. In order for the game to say, oh, I'm going to free it. It's gone. Okay. And then they need some visual parameters. You know, which texture or which mesh are you going to use to draw that particular particle? And you can use just a texture, a sprite, or you can use a mesh, or maybe something else. There is actually an algorithm out there which is called the marching cubes. Which is a way of, you know, taking a bunch of particles and figuring out a mesh that envelops those particles. And that's used for things like those water simulations I was talking about. Typically not in games, but it's not unheard of.
What is that called?
Marching cubes. You know, whether the particles, you know, have colors or transparencies or, you know, rotation. You know, you can have a particle that spins, or any other parameters that you need in order to render. Okay. And then the simulation is just simple. You know, just for each particle, every frame, you know, you run a loop like this for each particle. You calculate, you know, the force or acceleration directly. You know, if it's the same mass for the particles, then it's just calculate acceleration. You don't need to start multiplying the mass or anything like that. And then just do the simulation, and this is Euler integration. And then you say, oh, and it needs to get older, the particle. You could say, hey, you know, particles here, you know, will die after 5 seconds, say, if they haven't already. And every frame you do that for all the particles. Okay. As you can see, one particle does not interact with any other particle at any point. They're completely independent from each other, which simplifies things. Okay. Again, integration strategies, you know, this is the same stuff that I had before, only, you know, expressed a little more like code. Okay, which might help you. So you could do something like this, which is, you know, like midpoint integration. Also, as you can see, I'm not multiplying anything by the delta time. Because we're supposed to be playing a game, you know, every frame is, say, every 30th of a second. Okay? Regular intervals. The interval is always the same. So I can just express positions and velocities and everything, you know, already pre-multiplied by that, right? I don't need to do the same multiplication over and over and over again every frame. For no good reason. Okay. I can pick and choose my units. Right. So instead of seconds, it's 30ths of a second. And then I don't need to multiply by one.
So long as you have a fixed frame rate.
Hmm?
So long as you have a fixed frame rate.
So long as you have a fixed frame rate. And not just a fixed frame rate of rendering, a fixed frame rate of simulation of my particle system. Which is what this is about. Okay. For particles, the Runge-Kutta thing, you know, it's typically not quite so so interesting. Because Euler kind of works. I mean, particles don't have to be precise. They just have to look good. So what if it doesn't describe the actual parabola? I don't care. It describes a parabola. With parabolas, yes, you know, particles sometimes, you know, you can define forces any way you want. You can have, like, you know, wind eddies and things like that. So your particles actually seem to be moving with it, you know, which is more interesting than just falling, right? Collisions are basically the thing that makes physics complicated. In the case of particles, you might want to collide the particles against the walls and the floor and the ceiling, right? So, you know, I have particles which represent, you know, like a fire hose that I'm throwing against that wall, so maybe I want the water to actually bounce on the wall and, you know, like, the wall stops it. So you need those collisions. Okay. So collisions, the easy way is just every frame, you know, I move the particle and then I figure, did it actually enter any solid object of my scene, like the wall? Did it enter the wall? Did it enter the floor? I mean, collision against the floor is the simplest one, right? You know, is the height of my particle below the floor or not? Simple. So the first step is to figure out, did it collide? The second step is, what do I do about it? What does the particle do when it collides with floor? Well, if it's a drop of water, maybe I want it to do a little splash. Right? Or maybe I just want it to kill it. It disappears. You know, if you have sparks coming out of, you know, like a mill or something, then maybe they just disappear when they hit the floor. Or maybe they just bounce and a little bit and eventually vanish. Or whatever it is. The most typical kind of reaction, besides just disappearing, is the elastic bounce. The elastic bounce means that if a particle is moving this way and it hits the wall, it will continue with a velocity that is the perfect reflection on the normal of that wall. So I can make it collide against a sphere. As long as I have the normal on the surface at the point where it collides, I can always reflect it. And this is same as, you know, with the lighting formulas, you know, the specular light used that reflection around the normal, okay? In that case, it was figuring out this vector, this reflected vector, okay? In this case, what we want is the velocity coming in and then coming out, so it's just negate the whole thing, right? It's going the other way. That's it. I mean, it's just negate the whole result. But the formula is identical. The normal needs to be normalized. If the velocity is not, the formula actually takes care of it. Kind of nicely. Okay? The formula looks like this. Just reflection of the velocity is that. Of course, what happens if I have the wall here, and my particle is here, right? It's perfectly fine. And then I move it by this velocity, And then I figure, oh, it's inside of the wall. Mm-hmm. One thing that I can do is say, oh, well, it's inside of the wall. I don't care. I just calculate the new velocity, and it will come out of the wall in the next frame. That's the simplest. The simplest way. Okay. Another one that's been used is saying, oh, you know, so if it gets in the wall like this, then I'm going to say, oh, no, I'm just going to drop that result, and I'm just going to have it bounce over there. I mean, it's from one frame to the next, so, you know, the error is going to be within, you know, the interval between two frames. It's going to be small no matter what. Okay. Another way is to figure out how much of the trajectory is the interval before hitting the wall, right? So this is kind of like a percentage, you know. Between this frame and the next, where exactly does it bounce on the wall? Then figuring out this point, and then reflecting this vector here. So you say, hey, you know, one frame I'm here, and the next frame I'm there, and moving in that direction. Right? And that's kind of the perfect way. It's basically splitting the interval in two, and doing like two little simulations for it. You know, and that's more precise. Again, I can keep going with this, right? You do more precise math, it takes more time. I mean, hopefully not many particles collide with anything in any particular frame, right? They kind of average over time.
Well, that seems kind of easy because you just...
It is not complicated.
It is against the norm.
It is quite often, people don't even bother. Because it doesn't matter, as long as the alternative looks okay, then it's fine. You know, I mean, why bother with more precise math if the only benefit is, you know, that I feel better about myself, right? Maybe it looks ever so slightly better. But okay, there are cases where doing the right thing is better. Imagine, for instance, that you have geometry like this, right? So you have a ball that's coming in, you know, it's here, and it moves this far, right? So it is colliding here. Let's say, you know, let's say I don't do the right thing, and I just say, oh, you know, it went in, and it will come out next frame, right? I mean, bouncing over there is kind of like following that direction. So next frame is going to go here. And it's still inside, right? So you have to be careful what you assume, right? Doing the right kind of math takes care of problems like this. Of course, geometry like this, you don't find it very often, right? You know, particles bouncing on, you know, like the inside of a cone or something like that. That can happen. So if you do the right thing, then what you want is to reflect this portion, so it would go here. But it collided again, so now it bounces, and it bounces back, so it ends up being here and moving in that direction, okay? And I had to split in three different steps. And there is no way to limit how far, how many times you're going to need it. I mean, have you ever, you know, gotten a ping-pong ball and kind of, you know, pushed the paddle against the table, so it goes like, okay. That is many, many bounces per second at the very end. Okay, and your physics simulations can actually encounter those kind of situations. Okay. Your ball can get in a corner and not know how to get out. You know, your little particle can do that.
Is that what you mean by twitching?
No. I mean, the twitch is, you know, when you know, you have a body laying on the ground and the hand is going like this. And it never stops. And you don't know why. Right? It happens. And that's basically the physics integration that's diverging. Okay, so another thing that's kind of interesting sometimes is force fields. So force fields is saying, hey, you know, at different points in my scene, you know, the forces are different. You know, you can describe, hey, you know, wind over here is going that way, but over here it's coming this way, right? Or maybe it goes in a circle. So it, you know, it creates like a whirlwind type of thing. I mean, you could even make a force field and just throw particles in it, and they actually make like a tornado. You know, it's possible. You know, you need good math. I mean, diverging math will make the tornado go crazy. So force fields are a little bit like a texture of little vectors, of directions. You know, how much particles are pushed at this particular point. I mean, you could see a force field being, you know, laid on the ground, and then you put falling leaves, you know, that are pushed by a wind, you know, every which way, you know, capriciously. And, you know, you can describe that in a sort of 2D array or 3D array, or, you know, you can create formulas for it. You know, there are also choices there. The last thing is how to render sprites. And rendering sprites is just to make sure that you are, I mean, when you have a sprite, you just have a position, right? I mean, you have a point that's moving around. But when you render it, it's just a point. You might want to use also the velocity in order to, for instance, when you have sparks, you know, you instead of drawing just a little dot, you're drawing a line, you know, where it goes from one frame to the next. And it can look better. But, you know, typically, you know, you're just going to do sprites. So sprites is just a point. And you're going to render a point. And you render it by expanding it, making it big. And just drawing a texture there, where that point would be, around it. So you're going to have a certain size, which typically you express in like world units. So if you have a particle that's far away, it's still going to be very small. If it's very close, it's going to be bigger, right? You know, there are generally two choices. You can make it face the Z direction in view space, which is the easy math, and you can make it actually face towards where the observer is. So it's, you know, if it's further away, it's kind of turned a little more. This is slightly more physically correct. This is what everybody does. Okay. Again, the approximation that is good enough. Okay. You might want to consider something like this if you know you have something with very wide angle, for instance. But then again, you know, regular perspective math kind of breaks apart also when you have very wide angles. So, you know, there are other kinds of math that do it, but I haven't seen anybody but myself use it. I used it when I did not know any better. this was high school for me. And that's the main reason why I put it here, because I'm just proud of myself, I suppose. Everybody does this, just in the Z direction. Okay? This is how you do it. You have this size. This is the point. The point will correspond to the center of your sprite, right? So you have positive size and negative size in both directions. And what you need to find out is the X and Y directions that both axes of the sprite should follow in world space. Because you're positioning the whole thing in world space, right? So you're gonna calculate these four points and then, you know, let the world matrix, let the view and projection matrix take care of positioning it in the 3D world. So these two vectors, X and Y, okay, are the X and Y unit vectors of the view frame of, you know, the camera frame of reference. And you can extract them from the view matrix because they are the first two columns. Simple as that. Okay, just the three components. You know, the fourth component of the column is the position in along that axis, you know, of where the camera is in the world. And here you just need the unit vectors of the X and Y. So you take those two vectors and then you know, add and subtract, actually half the size. This is, add and subtract the size, which is, you know, half the width and half the height of the sprite on screen in the world. Okay. And then this texture can be, I don't know, just a puff of snow, of smoke, or whatever it is. You know, it's just something. Questions? There is actually something in D3D which is point sprites. You might read about it in the documentation. You might see samples that use them. I know that the implementation of point sprites can be tricky, you know, using them, because they're strange. Like, you know, they have limits on how big on screen they can be. So if they get closer, they don't get any bigger. In the past, I've had problems when students have used them, and they work in some computers and they don't in other computers, and I don't know why. I don't know what makes them fail. Not even after getting them on home assignments. So, you know, I strongly encourage you to just do, you know, calculate all 4 points in world space. Or view space. After all, you know, you just get the point, which is located in the world, multiply that point, multiply it by the view matrix, and what you get is that point in view space, in camera space. And then, you know, these vectors are just, you know, unit vector on the x, you know, so it's just, you know, adds the S and subtract the S on the X and Y coordinates of the position, you know, which makes it simpler. But conceptually, you can do it in any frame of reference you want. Doesn't matter.
Okay. The homework involves? The homework involves in a sense.
There is one last thing, which is esoteric, but, you know, games actually do this quite a bit, which is, you know, more wacky types of particle type things. And we saw some when we looked at Halo Reach, you know, a few classes ago, you know, where long beams like laser beams or, you know, trails from machine guns, things like that. You know, sometimes get rendered as this sort of sprites. And again, the only trick about this is knowing what the size of this is in world space, in world units, right? And then figuring out this vector, you know, how should you lay it out, right? Which is camera, you know, view dependent. And in this case, this vector has to be perpendicular to the vector between those two points and the vector from this point to the camera, right? So you just do a cross product of the two. And that gives you this direction. But I don't expect you to do this for homework or anything like that. But it's just good to know that's there. Sometimes, you know, the sprites can be not just one sprite, but three. One like this, and one cross like that. And then they don't face the camera. Right. They don't need to. And quite often trees are done like that. Trees. You know, it's just like two sprites like this, which do not face the camera. So that when you turn around it, you know, it's like, you know, the branches do. Yeah, they become paper thin, but the branches of the other one kind of take over in visual perception. A little bit. Okay. You know, I've seen trees done as six, you know. Like 60 degrees apart instead of 90. Right? Which is a little bit better. Still an approximation, but, anyway, that's that. Any questions? Okay. The homework is to give me a particle system. Give me some particles in your game. You know, make it rain, make it snow, put a fire, you know, that, is, you know, puffing up, or some smoke, or vapor breath out of Tiny. You know, that looks awesome, you know, if you do it right. Because, you know, you create particles, right? And you give them an initial velocity, right? Which is away from the mouth. And then Tiny looks the other way, but that vapor goes that way, but new one comes that way. So, you know, it looks actually very nice. You know, it's done a lot in things like, you know, Madden football and, they simulate sort of atmospheric effects by saying, hey, you know, it's cold, so the guy is actually puffing smoke out of the mouth. And it looks very nice. It's subtle, but adds richness to the game. So, the idea here is that, you know, you just do the tiniest little physics simulation with a few particles in your game. At one point, one of the students was doing a game that was, chase the rubber duckies in this ocean, right? So the maze was actually water, and, you know, there was no Tiny, it was rubber duckies, and what she did was, you know, there are bubbles coming up from the water, you know, and that was kind of neat. Use your imagination. I give you a little bit of extra grade if you make it so that the particles can collide with the world and have some sort of reaction. Okay? Some reaction could be they leave a hole, like, you know, they burn the wall and they leave something, a decal, like we saw. Or you could just make it so, you know, this is water falling and when it drops on the floor, it does a little splash. Or, you know, whatever you feel like, or maybe they just bounce correctly on the walls. Okay? Just make it so that they collide. Okay? Questions? As usual, we're running out of time. But by Thor, I'm going to show you a game. It doesn't work on the Xbox 360. And I was one of the guys who did the backwards compatibility emulation for it, and I did not give support to my own game. So those people out there that complain, why do you not support my game? Well, I did not support mine. It was not worth it. It sold about 30,000 copies worldwide. It was bad. It was just not fun. It was just not engaging. You know, it had some good things, but they were mostly geeky technical and not fun related, unfortunately. So, this is an original Xbox game. You know, I just wanted to show one of those games of the original Xbox that actually looks pretty neat, even for, you know, today's standards. The game is called Brute Force. Anybody played it?
A little bit.
So I remember it being one of those that, oh, it looks so good. I can skip every single cinematic. Those are just movies, real videos, MPEG-2, or similar. And these are in-engine. So you can see that there are, you know, already a few particle systems, you know, something like that is good enough. I mean, just, you know, a few, like, fire particles coming up. And those particles were just like little circles, you know, like blurry circles of red and yellow. I mean, I'm not asking you to be very artistic with it. If you are, so much the better, right? But I don't know how to be very artistic myself, so. Let's keep the tutorial menus and I don't know why it doesn't ever understand that I want inverted. Okay. So, as you can see, there is some things which are not exactly particles, but they're almost like particles, which are these little insects flying around, you know, like fireflies and that sort of thing. There is some smoke there in the background. So those are just like, you know, sprite spot, yay big, probably. And they're just coming up. In this case, it's constant speed. I mean, one thing about smoke is that it's being pushed up by buoyancy in the atmosphere, right? So gravity pushes down and buoyancy pushes up, and in the end it's just constant speed. Even something falling, there's something called terminal velocity. You know, that equation of drag that I showed you, eventually, you know, as the velocity increases, you know, you're falling out of a plane, you know, your velocity increases until at some point it's, you know, the force of drag is the same as the gravity. And at that point, you do not accelerate anymore. You know, you're at constant velocity. And that's called terminal velocity. It depends on that drag coefficient, you know, the K that I put in my formula. Yeah, it also depends on your aerodynamics. You know, if you extend your arms, then, you know, you offer more drag. You know, if you, you know, push your head down and, you know, go down like a bullet, then you go faster. Just because there's less drag. So, you know, there are just some really nice things about, you know, everything about how this game looks. You know, this guy, it uses a lot of alpha testing for vegetation. It has, remember Halo? You know, the vegetation was kind of sparse, right? And here it's everywhere, which is pretty nice. And, you know, lighting is also much more interesting. There's one thing that we'll see when we talk about more advanced lighting, but you know, you can see that there's light over here, and there's also light on that side. You know, that's what's called the Fresnel effect. You can actually see in people, you know, when the parts of their faces that are actually facing sideways from where you are, you know, tend to be brighter, just because when light kind of glances of an object, it's more likely to bounce off of it than if it's falling straight on it. So, anyway. Yeah, I see enemies. Or something. Of course it looks good, but you know, it's still kind of, they look like robots walking around. So let me just get rid of them. So again, you know, you can see little particle effects. I should, you know, things bounce off the wall, you know, there's a little bit of smoke, you know, all that sort of thing. I mean, particle effects in games, typically, you know, you'll see many. Even if you play just a short time. You can see a little bit particle effect here in the muzzle of the gun. So it puts out a particle that kind of fades over time, but stays where it is. So if I'm rotating, you know, my gun kind of moves away from that muzzle flash, you know, because it has a certain permanence. It's not just instant, right? Same thing with the smoke. You know, as I turn, the smoke is like, you know, trails this way. And it's just because it stays where it is. I am the one who's spinning, right? And then also, you will notice that the smoke here, you know, seems to be kind of sprites, it's fuzzy stuff. But there's also like chunks coming out this way, you know, little debris. And those are little, tiny little solid meshes. So sometimes particles are rendered as meshes, not as sprites. It all depends on, you know, what looks better. You know, what does it represent in the real world, and how do you render that best? Yeah, there'll be people there. They're telling me to learn how to use grenades. That sort of thing, so. Let me do that. You know, again, you know, the trail of the grenade, you know, it's just particles that get generated and stay as the grenade moves away. You know, there's really nothing more to it. Oh. So there's one explosion over there, and I killed him. Hmm? Huh? Yeah, yeah. Here you have those puffs of fire. So again, you have very simple texture animation over here, like the conveyor belt, like, you know, the water in Halo, same thing. It's just moving. And then, you know, they just have a little spurt of particles. So again, you know, that's what happens with particles. You know, they get generated at some place with some velocity. They follow some formula for movement, which is usually just physics. You know, the simplest physics that exist, which is Euler integration with constant gravity. And eventually they die. Mm. You don't want them to any particle to suddenly disappear. So if you're going to kill them while they're still visible, you know, you want to either make them smaller over time or fade so they get more transparent over time. Again, artistic choices. Okay. Questions? Comments? Or goodbyes? Or see you next week? Oh, there's one last thing. Sorry. Very, very quickly. This next week is spring, midwinter break. In school, so I do not have duties at the library. Okay? You guys have not been using it, really, except for one of you. So I'm not gonna be there unless you tell me that you're gonna be. Okay? So if anybody wants to meet with me on Tuesday, we can go to the Redmond Library. Otherwise, you know, I will just not be there. So don't come looking for me. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I don't expect everybody to be able to do this at the same time I do. I just put there that time in case anybody finds it useful. This week, you will have to let me know first.
Thanks,
Jacob. Sure. Sorry. Thank you for coming.
I'm marking myself off when I stand up. That's probably me.
Mm-hmm. There. Mm-hmm. Have a nice week. Good luck with the homework. Please finish it. Don't wait until the last minute to ask for questions on how to do it.